Let's go.
Welcome to Micromobility, a podcast exploring the disruptive potential of lightweight utility vehicles. Using the history of computing as a framework, we examine how these technologies will upend everything we thought we knew about the future of urban transport. The host of the show is Horace Dedu, founder of Asimco.com, and I'm his co-host, Oliver Bruce.
Hey team, Oliver here. Really excited to bring this episode to you. Apollo Scooters are one of these really exciting companies that just quietly ship. I have been following them since they first unveiled the Apollo Pro at Micromobility Europe last year. And then last year, they managed to ship out 30,000 scooters, which is a pretty decent amount for a company that has never raised any outside capital. In this conversation, we run through the founding of the company, the opportunities that exist in the space, their journey with being direct-to-consumer and focusing on being an e-commerce brand, who they admire in the space, and what they think is interesting. I really appreciated both Max and Chris's humility and how they are running the company and their perspective on the space. Thanks to them for joining, and I really hope that you enjoy this episode. In the meantime, if you haven't already, please consider getting some tickets for Micromobility Europe. It'll be on June 8th and 9th this year, and Horace, myself, and the whole crew will be there. This year, we have opened up the Startup Awards to a whole heap of companies, and we already have at least 55 who are going to be presenting some of the most exciting vehicles I have seen in the space to date. Be sure to check it out at micromobility.io and come and join us. But with that, here's Maciek and Chris.
Let's go.
All right, and welcome back to Micromobility. I have with us today Maciek and Chris from Apollo Scooters. How are you today, guys?
Great, thank you, Bruce. Thanks for having us. Thank you very much.
Oh, most welcome. Yeah, no, hey, look, great to have you on. I've been wanting to have this conversation really since I met you in Micromobility America, and you'd shared a little bit about your progress, and I was blown away. You know, there's a lot of companies out there that have trying to ship scooters, but don't have, you know, for whatever reason, have not yet kind of got able to ship. And I really, really appreciated just chatting with you and realizing like, wow, you've raised next to no capital at that point, and you've managed to ship a lot of scooters. So I thought I'd just take the opportunity to kind of unpack that a little bit with you. So maybe what we can do is, do you want to just take me through like who the two of you are, how did you meet, and then how did Apollo get started?
Sure. So I'm Chris, one of the co-founders at Apollo. I do sales and at affiliates mostly. And my name is Mac, and I'm the CEO, and I take care of everything else. So yeah. In terms of the background and how we met, so me and Maciek both studied at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We then moved our journey to Montreal, working at L'Oreal, so a big cosmetic company, which is great for 2 years. And then we essentially, you know, we're looking for electric scooters for our personal use. So Maciek was looking to buy one, and we were roommates at the time. So we were looking to try and buy scooters, and nobody was selling them in Canada and the US. So we were like, that's quite weird. So we looked at potentially buying them from China. I mean, first we put a few ads on Facebook and Google and all these marketplaces, just prototyping. And the next morning we had 50 messages from people saying, I want to buy. So we're like, wow, that's amazing. There's a huge demand and no supply. So we essentially started a business straight away, literally bought 10 scooters, sold that, and said, that was pretty easy. So then we bought 50, 100, and it grew from there. And these were just Segway and Xiaomi scooters. And that was really phase one. Phase two was, once it started growing, we sort of said, okay, let's go to China. There's an opportunity for better hardware and better products. And we visited all the factories of scooters, and there weren't many that were quite good. So we started doing an OEM, and we sort of, you know, did a product branding behind it. And that goal, that was a phase two, and that goal was to sort of raise enough money through sales and reinvest all the profits to create our own brand and our own design. And that's where the Apollo Phantom came the year after. So once we designed the Apollo Phantom and we launched that, that was really a new venture for us. And that's where we started dabbling into the hardware design side of it. So our biggest differentiator, in fact, there in the start was customer service. That was our priority. That was our everything. And marketing. So we realized the potential of marketing and the power of it coming from L'Oreal. And that really allowed us to get enough capital to inject more into our products as we went. And then, yeah, I guess fast forward till today, we're a team of 50 here in Montreal. We've probably sold last year around 30,000 scooters in 12 different countries. And yeah, we're in a great spot looking forward into the future and excited to share it with you.
Yeah, totally. You make it sound so easy.
You see gray hairs, right? I mean, it's not.
So that I want to unpack that journey. So actually, maybe what we'll do is we'll start today. So what are the, what, you know, like how many models do you have? You said you had 50 people, you're selling into 12 markets around the world. Is there anything else that you can share in terms of like where you're at in terms of scale, et cetera, today?
Yeah, definitely. So today our portfolio consists of 5 products, but we're actually actively working to consolidate that just to down to 3 products. We've had a couple of insights over the years, and we realized that actually you can probably capture about 80% of the market with just 3 products. And if you are able to package them correctly, offer them in configurable variants, you should effectively be able to do most of what we do today in terms of sales volume, if not more, but with a much more streamlined portfolio. And that in theory allows you to consolidate your resources from an advertising point of view, from an internal operations point of view, from an engineering point of view, in just 3 products, right? So that's sort of where we are at in terms of product today. Like Chris mentioned, we pushed about 30,000 units last year, and we're hoping to do more this year, although we're actually quite open about the fact that 2023 is not going to be the breakout year for us. We really believe that 2024 will be that year for a number of reasons, and we'll get there as well. But as you might recall from our micromobility presentation back in Amsterdam last year, we sort of set out to accomplish this goal of putting 1 billion kilometers on Apollo vehicles by 2030.
Yep.
And that has been the overarching North Star for us ever since. And really, the name of the game has changed completely since that time. Because all of a sudden we're starting to think about, you know, how do we put more riders on our scooters, point one, and point two, how do we actually get them to ride for longer or more? And I think that second point is really important because very few companies are actually asking those questions. You know, most scooters are designed to have a lifespan of about 2,000 to 3,000 kilometers. We're trying to build them for 10,000 kilometers. So they're actually rivaling mopeds and bicycles in terms of what the expected lifespan is. And that's, you know, kind of opened our eyes to a whole new array of engineering challenges. And that's what we've been working through over the last 12 months. And the Pro that we announced in Amsterdam last year is really an exciting example of a product that I think culminates all of that R&D and those efforts into one vehicle. So for anyone who hasn't heard of the Apollo Pro, we highly recommend you check it out and take a look at it.
Yeah, well, the Apollo Pro was certainly an eye-catching addition to, we had the Petra Kutcher in Amsterdam, and it was actually awesome because we had like all these different amazing vehicles lined up, and obviously yours was in there as well, and that was really exciting. But it's a beast, like it's quite a large, it's a big, big scooter. Do you want to just take us through the specs on that? And then I'm keen to can you just sort of lay out what those 3 models are going to be? Like, what are the interesting areas of scooters, and like, what are those 3 packages that you talk about? And then where does the Pro sit in that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Pro is the top of the pyramid in terms of performance, weight, price point. And it's a $4,000 scooter like I mentioned, will be really the Model S for Apollo, right? It's the product that kind of pioneered a lot of the technology that we're now working to massify through the increasingly affordable models. The middle of the pack will be the Apollo Explore. And what's unique about it that we'll be revealing over the next 30 or 60 days is the fact that it comes with a swappable battery. So we're actually looking at it as a really great avenue to explore commercial partnerships with. And, you know, we've been getting inquiries from hotels, resorts, golf courses since day one, and they all want to have our scooters and be able to leverage them for rentals and whatnot for different guests that come in. But unfortunately, we were never quite able to accommodate that due to the lack of swappable batteries. So we're really excited to be able to crack that door open as well. And then the bottom of the pyramid there will be the Apollo Lite. So the Apollo Lite is from the very get-go designed to have the same cutting-edge technology that will be available in the Apollo Pro, but in a much more lightweight package. So it's a scooter that will be, we're hoping under 15 kilos. We're actually just expecting to get the first sample, the first prototype in about 2 months. And this is a scooter that we're really optimizing for mass distribution. So we're from the very beginning designing it to be compact enough to, you know, we're taking container considerations into the picture. We're starting to think about, you know, how many can you put in one of them? How shippable is it? You know, is it expensive? Is it cheap? We're really thinking about commercial considerations because we want it to be the scooter that really reaches the masses. And that's only possible by partnering up with the Best Buys and the Costcos of this world.
And just to add on to that, I think over the last 3 years, what's been great is that we've amassed a lot of consumer information. We do enormous amounts of consumer tests, and we're now building scooters that are based off, you know, how consumers are using scooters, not rather than doing what other companies, I guess, are doing, or are just, you know, jam-packing scooters with the enormous amounts of speed, range, and everything else. And that's why a lot of our, like, we have over 15,000 active riders today who are all logging trips into the app. We see exactly how they ride, the average speed, the distance. And that allows us to create those products in order to say, okay, the light's going to be a mass market, and this is a range, weight, and the perfect need case for it. And that's how we're sort of going around these products. So it's really a different approach now that we have the data, which is fantastic, and it allows us to hit that consumer need even more.
Yeah, awesome. So the pro, okay, so talk me through those specs, because I think, just so I understand, so sub 15 kgs, but you're still talking like more than, is it like a 250 watt motor on the light? And then, you know, how big are we talking on the pro?
Yeah, so the pro, you're looking at dual 1200 watt motors and a 52 volt battery configuration. So top speed around 40 miles per hour. And, you know, in terms of range, you're looking at something, we're hoping to be able to crack 60 miles in terms of total range. Of course, that depends on a lot of variables, but you know, the really interesting thing about the Pro, like Chris just said, is that those are actually relatively modest specs, if you believe it. You know, you look at some of these beast scooters out there, and you know, at some point you've got to ask yourself, is it still a scooter if it goes 100 kilometers per hour, right?
Yeah.
And should it even be a scooter to begin with? And so we completely agree that going 40 miles per hour, you know, is totally outrageous. And most of our customers don't go 40 miles per hour. We, like Chris mentioned, know based on data that our customers actually ride about 25 miles per hour on average, right? Like that's kind of the cruising speed that they tend to hover around. And so that was a really deep insight for us to see the super powerful scooters that we're putting out there are not being used to their full potential. And what were some of the feedback that we were getting was, well, you know, I wish I could use my phone, you know, for navigation while I was riding, you know, okay, that makes sense. I wish I could brake, you know, electronically so that I don't waste my mechanical brakes and I have to, you know, swap up my brake pads every 3 months or so. And, you know, I keep getting flat tires. So there were a lot of reliability concerns. There were a lot of user usability concerns. You know, there were a lot of, I would say, experience-driven concerns around the product that were not being addressed. And so the Pro was really a kind of a deviation from the race for more speed and more power, and a turn towards how do we make a scooter that feels integrated, that feels like it's meant to work together, that offers a seamless riding experience. And so we're really, really proud to say that, you know, it's a scooter that is not only proprietary for us, but it also features a proprietary controller that we developed from the ground up, which allows it to be the first 52 volt scooter, the first high performance scooter to have a dedicated regen brake, to use phone as display. So we're partnering up with QuadLock, you know, a really reliable kind of phone mount manufacturer. And we've developed this whole technology where you pop the Apollo app open, you mount your phone as display, and voila, you're good to go. Self-healing tires, 360 lighting. So a lot of safety considerations too. And ultimately, I think what becomes the cornerstone of the Pro is this unibody frame. So no other scooters at that price point do it because, frankly, it's really expensive to create just one gigantic cast of aluminum that becomes the frame. But that's part of the reason that, one, the Pro is incredibly robust and reliable, but secondly, that it achieves this seamless kind of edgy look with no screws and cables. So a lot of new ideas and concepts being pioneered in the Pro. And like I mentioned at the beginning, we're really excited about them because now that we've developed a lot of this technology, we're actually able to bring it to a more affordable price point in different vehicles.
Just to add on what Matrick was inside, just missed out was, again, the IoT is an incredible component of the Pro, allowing consumers to have, you know, at all times access to where their scooter is with theft detection as well, which is really, really important. And that's what our consumers are asking for. So yeah, the feature set is a must.
Totally. I just to go back as well. So that's the Pro twin 1200 watt motors. I mean, that's like for anybody who's ridden any, like I have a boosted rev, which is like 1600 watt peak. And that's amazing. Like it's really such a, I remember the first time I rode it, I was like, it's incredible. You can get this much power into a little package and that's way less than that. So, but I'm curious. So, you know, obviously like the lower end of the market, you're talking, what's the sort of specs you're talking about for the Explorer and for the Lite?
Yeah. So the Explorer, we're looking at something, like I mentioned, that will have a swappable battery. So in terms of range, you can, you know, in theory, go up to whatever you want as long as you're willing to carry those battery packs. But we agree with you that the dual motor acceleration that you got from your boosted rev is tough to beat. You know, you kind of, even if they're low wattage motors, there's something about that ability to climb a hill or that instant acceleration that just puts a smile on your face. So we're big believers in dual motor configurations. So the Explorer, we're looking at probably dual 500 likely in a 52 volt battery configuration. But I think, you know, as we unveil it over the next couple of months, you'll see that it's actually the form factor of the scooter that's quite unique. So without giving too much away, it's going to be a very big deviation from our norm in terms of design principles. And we're hoping that because of that, it kind of garners a lot of attention for its design. And then the light, like I mentioned, we're really just obsessing over the weight of the product. You know, we can't emphasize that enough, that it needs to be lightweight enough to pick it up, bring it on the train. It's going to be the most conventional of our scooters, if you will, but still utilizing all of the same cutting edge tech that we've developed for the Pro, unpackaged in a nice design.
Awesome. And that's for the Explore and for the Lite?
Yeah, so the Lite would have been the more conventional one I just mentioned, but...
Okay. Fascinating.
Sorry, I was just going to jump in and quickly say that, you know, I think a lot of these scooters seem really basic on the surface, and, you know, like most hardware and micromobility, the components that make up a scooter aren't actually that complicated. It's really when you apply the notion of reliability to it, that's when you start to see a lot of the design flaws come to the surface. And, you know, even the most reliable manufacturers that we've seen today are not designing their products to last 10,000 kilometers. So I think although our products may look a little bit simple on the surface, really understanding where those cracks appear down the road has been such a tremendously interesting journey for us that's made us go back to first principles in terms of design and engineering and really rethink how we build scooters from the ground up.
Totally. Well, that's kind of, I want to ask, you know, who do you think has done it well? Because I think I want to give the context, which is in the beginning when shared scooters came out, you know, like electric scooters had kind of been around, but it was not a thing. Like it was, you know, they were, a couple of people were buying them. I remember seeing people in Singapore who had them in like 2015, but they weren't common. Then when you were able to access them via just walking up to a smartphone, obviously the early days of Bird and Lime were terrible in terms of they were just running like Segway ES2s that just weren't, you know, high quality. And over time, what you've seen is that the shared scooters have gone incredibly heavy duty. And so they're now like heavy, heavy beasts with, you know, big swappable batteries and all that sort of stuff. And then in the private scooter design world, there's been a little bit of innovation, but a lot of that has kind of come off the back of the shared scooter stuff. So you use the stuff you see from Xiaomi and some of the things you see from like Okai and stuff. But yeah, just curious for you, what are the design, like, how do you look at designing for personally owned as being different from any of those other design challenges, for example? Like, are you, because how many others are like specifically designing for what you are designing for? I guess is the question that I have.
Yeah, that's a good question. And to be honest, we don't really think there is anybody in our space that's approaching design in the same way as we are. And the interesting point here is that we actually draw a lot of inspiration from our friends at Cowboy and Van Moof. So we look at what the bike industry has done from a design perspective, how they've taken an industry that was so mature and you know, unchanged for so many decades and did something new with it. So we actually draw a lot of inspiration from them. We look at Sonos, we look at DJI, a lot of other companies in other industries. But within the scooter world specifically, like you correctly mentioned, you know, shared scooters are optimizing for purely mileage, right? They just want to be able to be in the market for as long as possible, putting as many kilometers or miles on them as possible without braking, because that's what drives revenue for those operators. In the privately owned segment, what ultimately matters is, does this scooter fit my needs, right? Like, is it doing the job that I want it to do? And that's when you get into the three main segments, the three main use cases that we've been able to identify in the personal ownership world. And we kind of call them, you know, internally, by the consumer names that we've come up with. But really the three main segments would be commuters. So somebody who's looking for something to ultimately replace their car with. It's probably a scooter that doesn't need to go further than 20 kilometers in range. It's something that needs to be, you know, foldable. They can bring it upstairs, put it under the desk, and they're kind of good to forget about it for the rest of the day. The second segment we see are people who are, we call them social riders, and they really enjoy they look at scooters as an alternative to going for a bike ride with friends on a Sunday afternoon. You know, it's something that they will take to a park, have a great time on. It becomes an activity for them, and then they bring it back home and they forget about it for another week. And then the third and the most recreational segment that we see in the privately owners, the private ownership segment is the enthusiasts. So those are people who really go after the kind of 60 kilometers and up scooters. They want to modify them. They want to be able to, you know, replace everything in their life with those scooters. And we see them really be very invested in the community more than anything else. So if you kind of extrapolate from those three different segments, you're able to segment the entire privately owned scooter market, actually. And most scooters will fall into one of these three categories. That's kind of the you know, origin of the thesis that we think we can corner the whole market, which is three models.
And just to jump on to that, even on the public side, so like I remember when Segways and the Birds and all started, a scooter would last 28 days on average before they have to change it. And like you said, then they remove the suspension, they remove the tires. And when you look at the private use case, you see, I think people undervalue the complexity of creating a product in a private use space that has suspension, that has all these moving parts. And we've seen a lot of examples of like the Rain scooter, the Scotsman, the Unagi, the Model 11. Like concepts are very easy to make, but actually going through the execution and doing it's much harder. And so I think one of the best examples is the Proto Pro. So the way we launched that scooter overall is we had a prototype and we went through six different iterations, releasing all of those iterations on YouTube, walking through it for the customers or potential customers and asking for feedback. Like we were super transparent since day one. It was amazing the amount of feedback we were getting. It's like, okay, you don't have a display, but I want a display. I don't want to use my phone. So we added a dot display. I want self-heating tires. I want this X, Y, and Z. So we've done five iterations of that. Then we have a beta program, which we have 150 customers have to put 500 miles on the beta platform and sign off saying this product is market ready. And then we launch. So you're looking at a two-year process. And I think honestly, being where we are instead of the financial impact of us is that we're very, very careful and we're very like about the capital that we inject into these things. So everything has to be perfectly calculated and executed, which is why we've been able to launch again the Phantom, the City, and potentially the Pro, all our designs type of thing. So
yeah. What is the time frame on like, speaking of which, it's an uncomfortable and slightly awkward question, but around the, you know, like the industry is full of people who have designed Pro scooters, the Scotsman, as you say, the Unagi 11, which obviously got pulled, the Boosted Rev, which obviously shipped but then got pulled because they went bankrupt. Like, this is a horrible, there's not exactly an excellent track record. And one of the things, again, I've been excited about in the conversation with you is that you ship, you've got 30,000 scooters going out the door last year. So it's not like we're starting from zero, but you know, what are the risks that you see for a launch of the Pro to be able to get it out to market, and how are you mitigating from that?
In terms of the Pro specifically, you know, like Chris mentioned, being very public about the development process just without a doubt garners a following. People feel invested in making that scooter with you. They feel rewarded when you make changes based on their suggestions. And those ultimately become our first, you know, 150 customers that participate in the beta program. And so there's already a ton of awareness about the product. Also, thanks to, you know, you and what you guys were able to do at the Micromobility Conference last year in Amsterdam. So I think taking it slow and being very public about the development process is critical, both in ensuring that you make a product that meets customers' needs, but also in terms of promoting it and creating awareness for the product. And then, you know, the next step for us is really releasing it on Indiegogo or Kickstarter and being able to gauge demand for our first couple production runs to see, you know, is it going to be as big of a hit as we think it is, or do we think it's actually going to be a bit smaller? So, you know, again, I don't know how many companies that aren't externally backed go through this number of precautions to make sure they're spending their capital carefully, but we don't have the luxury of, you know, making mistakes necessarily, and we are very cautious with our capital. And those are all the reasons that we ultimately put ourselves through these very difficult, complicated, but customer-centric, and ultimately, deeply, I think, learning experiences that allow us to make a product that meets the needs of the market and ends up being a reliable one out of the gate, as opposed to something that flops.
What's the time frame on the Pro launch in theory?
So we're aiming for a June, July Kickstarter and deliveries as of October.
So yeah, the beta program starts next month. And also really fun news is that we just also found out that we won the Red Dots Design Award last week as well, which is huge.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So awesome. We go through all these things, which our designer, Yago, and our CTO, Elwa, they work so hard on the design of it. And it's, again, using that customer feedback, then great for the testing process and then the launch process. So that's a good hit of credibility that we're doing something right in the design front. Now it's a launch process that's going to be the biggest priority.
Yeah, totally. That makes sense to me. And what's the, you know, like if you look out at the wider industry, so there's a couple of things I just want to like give context for as well. So McKinsey came out, I think probably late last year, and talked about the expansion of micromobility, that there's, you know, where they see the biggest area of growth is actually in these kick scooters, their current market cap for the total like market size for all scooters at the moment, electric kick scooters, is about $4 billion a year. But they reckon it'll be $70 billion by the end of 2030. So there's obviously like huge amounts of growth in this space. When you look around, does it feel like that? Like, does it feel like that's where the really, really big growth is going to be happening? Because the one thing I want to give context to is you're not externally funded. There aren't that many other, like there are a couple of scooter companies that I know that exist and are trying to build stuff, but it's incredibly challenging to get funding for them. Like everybody hates funding hardware, you know, like it's a really, really messy.
Especially this year. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially this year. Right. So the part that I can't quite get my head around is like, we've got this McKinsey coming out and saying this, you've got Paris who's just gone and banned all the shared scooters. So we know that there's going to be like an explosion of personally owned scooters because people are just going to go like, yeah, I want to have something that's for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's also been this kind of interesting world in which the scooter manufacturers themselves have been struggling.
Yeah, you know, I think we can kind of dissect that in three ways because it's a really good point, right? Like this should be an oasis and everyone should be kind of drinking water from it, but it actually feels more like a desert instead, right? So what's going on? And yeah. I think the first point here is that I don't know for certain that this is where the growth is coming from, but I would wager that a lot of the scooters that are being sold are extremely affordable, kind of around $500 price point, Walmart, Amazon type of products. That's where the volume is. And that's fine. You know, a lot of people start there. And we actually see in our surveys of our customers that about 55% of our customers come to us to upgrade from an entry-level product. So we love being their Mercedes. You know, we don't want to be their Honda or whatever car they buy as the first vehicle. We want to be the kind of upgrade vehicle when you're, you know, about to get serious, you know, about your commute or family or whatever. So we see that too. The second thing that we see a lot is, you know, there were a lot of kind of spectacular implosions in the micromobility space as well, right? Like a handful of companies that raised a lot of money and went belly up, which I think generally doesn't encourage investors to jump right in and kind of write checks to other companies. And then the third and the final thing is, I think, you know, in our case, we didn't actually start a tech company or a scooter company. We started an e-commerce company. So we were always focused on generating cash and sales first. And only then, after doing this for a handful of months, if not years, did we say, well, hold on, there's kind of a problem with this product, right? It sucks for a number of reasons. I think we can do a better job here. So rather than, I think, most companies coming in and trying to do the opposite, right? They don't have a business. They're trying to build a product. We built a business and then built a product, which I think, you know, in the end ended up being a bit of a saving grace for us.
Who are the competitors? Well, how do you think about competitors in the market? Like, who do you look at and go, oh, yeah? Both in terms of like the e-commerce side and the actual just getting scooters out and distribution side and the, hey, we're building products and these are the, you know, scooters that we look around and go, oh, yeah, we respect them.
Yeah, I think on the manufacturing side, we really respect Segway. You know, it's the company we compete with by far the most in terms of overlap with our customers, especially now that they've entered this kind of mid-market and premium segments as well with their high-performance scooters. And honestly, they're just a machine. The ability to design products, manufacture them to spec, inspect them accordingly, ship them in one piece, you know, deliver them through a million channels and still deliver a high quality product is just spectacular. You know, as a company that only really owns one channel, which is just direct, we already see the complexity that comes with that. And they're able to own, you know, tens of channels and still do it really, really effectively. So all the way from how they design and manufacture their products to how they distribute and sell them, we're really looking at Segway and recently new as well. You know, they've entered the North American market with their scooters last year and they've made a killing, it seems like, in the first 12 months. Effectively competing with Segway.
Yeah.
So we look at them for inspiration from a kind of pure volume perspective. But like I mentioned before, you know, in terms of more of like what kind of business do we want to be? Because we don't want to be a business that sells, you know, 500,000, million scooters a year. That's not what we're after. We're after creating products that replace cars, you know, and until we get to a point, like you have correctly, you know, mentioned many, many times on this podcast, where the consumers are ready to understand that one vehicle doesn't solve all the use cases. And in fact, you need multiple vehicles for multiple use cases. We're not going to be able to see that kind of volume. So, you know, I think that perhaps the last point to your question, which is, you know, what's going on with this industry is that we just need a bit of a consumer shift here. We need people to finally realize, actually, I don't need to take my car everywhere. And that's why we did start with the Pro, because it's outrageous. It's so over the top. And we wanted people to notice, you know, And now that they hopefully are, we're able to take those insights, take those learnings, and apply them to more affordable products.
Yeah. Who else other than Segway do you look at in the industry and go, yeah, I really respect what you're doing?
In the scooter world, not many, to be honest. I think we'd look at bikes, like you said. I think bikes is the best one. And that's why we just try and focus on that and create more like a love brand and really work with the customer. But
you know, there are companies that are doing interesting things, right? It's just, I think, like you pointed out before, it's a question of how many of them can actually execute. You know, we love Bo. Bo makes beautiful scooters. But let's actually see what kind of a business they can build with that scooter, right?
Yep.
Same with Pure. I mean, their new foldable scooter that fits, you know, under your desk, it's fantastic, but it's still on pre-order. So it just feels that we've gotten excited and intimidated by a lot of competitors before, and then 90% of them never made it to market. So we're just very reluctant to say, this is fantastic, because until it's a product that's been in market for 6 months, and it hasn't snapped in half.
Yeah,
you know, it's not really something that we can sign up on.
And it's a shame, because even like you mentioned Boosted, I think Boosted was a fantastic example of, okay, they might not have got the hard, they might not have got, sorry, the execution right in the long term, but they created a love brand that people still use today, buy today, love today. Like Casey Neistat still, you know, raves about his skateboards. And that for us is one of the biggest things. They were at one with their customer, and they created just absolutely incredible product. So us, we're trying to do a mix between not become the Segway and a huge part of it, but create a love brand that we can actually innovate and have this culture, like this cult following behind,
yep,
to create such a beautiful space.
Yeah, totally. I think as well, I mean, I love my Boosted. I still ride it. There's a billionaire in my city who has like six of them, and that's his like his preferred means of getting around, which I've always found like hysterical. And I kind of look at that and I'm like, I was actually having a conversation with the boys from Bo, as you mentioned them. But there's like, as we think about brand, I think that this world is going to end up, because I think about my love affair with the Boosted Rev and what that world will look like. And I think in some ways it's like the early days of cars. You know, people kind of looking at these things as utilitarian, but there's actually something to be said for like the equivalent of motorbikes or vehicles. People are going to fall in love with them like they do cars and car brands. And Van Moof is the perfect example, right? Like Van Moof just like have nailed design and they're imitated by a whole heap of people, never very well. And you can kind of know when you see a Van Moof that it's a special vehicle, that there's been care and love and attention that's been put into it. And I don't know, the other part that I've been thinking about, because you know, when we're talking about the investment side of the scooter business, has just been, I don't know who understands that in the investor world, that there will be brands and they will be loved and that will be worth something. And I'm just kind of curious if you have any reflections on that.
So yeah, and even just while you're mentioning different brands, I think another example of a great one is Cake.
Yes. Yeah.
Is a perfect example of, they know where they're going. It's a business utility. It doesn't feel like it's a consumer perfect product. And that, back to your question, is what investors are probably looking at in different ways as well. It's like they have a clear model, they have clear execution plans, and they're doing everything perfectly in terms of the execution. I think that's really like the safe option for an investor to go into.
Yeah, I think you know, the fundamental issue is that there is oftentimes a bit of a conflict of interest. You know, we do entertain conversations with people every once in a while, because you never know what kind of opportunity is going to come your way. But the typical response we get from anyone we speak to is, you know, I'll give you X amount of dollars and I want to know how you're going to make it, you know, Y amount of dollars in 3 years time, right? And it's always just a game of, how do I put in some amount and get 10X 3 years later? And whenever we respond with, but hold on, it's going to take us 7 years to build this amazing business that we think is going to change the world, at least in this way, we typically lose their interest, you know, and that's fine with us, because it clearly means there isn't a fit. But this is a very long-term game. And then we are looking at 2030 and beyond, and we're thinking about how our vehicles need to evolve. We're thinking about how our servicing needs to evolve. We're thinking about vertical integration and the challenges and the opportunities that come with that. We're thinking about how our business model needs to evolve to be able to get to a level where we are, in fact, able to put 1 billion kilometers in our vehicles. And most people are just not interested in those types of questions. So maybe it's a function of who we speak to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So I do want to ask. So you haven't taken any external capital to date. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. It's entirely self-funded. I mean, that is just hats off to you, because that's pretty rare in this world. But the other part about it as well is like, So one of the big conversations that the other groups that I've seen in micro, right? Like I've interviewed Kyle Dursick from One Wheel. He also similarly, they took capital, but like way later, like they did nothing. Boosted, you know, in the early days, did it on Kickstarter. Super Simulator 3 did it on Kickstarter. There's sort of a whole bunch of folks who have done that as the using Kickstarter, using their customers in advance to be able to do that. I don't know. I'm still not entirely convinced that's the best model, but it certainly has been a model that has been used by a whole bunch of others. The thing that strikes me as being interesting is that there's a space that exists for someone to come in and do like a private equity play, but, you know, whose long-term capital can see that there's good businesses here, but they just, you know, they need to be patient. It's not venture returns anymore.
Good record.
Curious if you found anybody who's like that, who's thinking about the space. Do you think that I'm correct in my assessment in the space? Like, is that the right kind of capital?
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be a game changer for the industry if we're able to collectively be approached by an institution, let's say, that has this long-term view and that is able to kind of assemble, you know, almost different form factor vehicles and bring them together under this umbrella of let's build something special here. And I think what you notice about the companies that have been successful, the ones that you just mentioned, is that they're all, or rather, none of them are mass market products. They're all relatively niche products. You know, Super 73 in particular is a company that's all about, you know, kind of freedom and fun. And so is One Wheel, right? It's all about adventure. And they're not really trying to play in this like urban, everyday commuting mobility space, because that's where typically we see shared operators kind of take up that space. And they're not really doing that well, right? So one thing that, you know, your question kind of popped into my head as well is our long-term vision in terms of business model evolution. And what I'm getting at here is that today we're really focused on cracking the hardware and the software integration, creating that seamless experience, making products that last for 10,000 kilometers. But, you know, the kind of overarching question here is why? Why do we care about all of that? Aside from the obvious kind of benefits that it's good for consumers. But where I'm going with this is that ultimately where we see an opportunity is creating this notion of micromobility or mobility as a service.
Yep.
And the best way of describing that is not actually a subscription, which is kind of what a lot of people are playing with. But we see ourselves as more of a Verizon or AT&T one day, where instead of selling, you know, 10 gigs of data per month, we're selling you 100 kilometers of range or 1,000 kilometers of riding distance, you know, whatever it is. And
oh, interesting. So folks effectively get the scooter and they get 100 kilometers of range on it. And then if they want to buy extra kilometers, then they can.
That's right.
Otherwise, yeah, wow.
And what's interesting about that is that, you know, if you think about what dictates your vehicle needs, more often than not, it's your life stage. So if you're a student, you probably have a need for, let's say, a longboard to get around campus. And then you become a young adult and maybe a scooter becomes suitable. And then you become a parent or something and you want to have a bit more cargo space. And then maybe you're looking at having a small car. And so, you know, what's been interesting about this idea for us is that we're really focusing on scooters because like you correctly pointed out, they're growing the fastest. We think we have an opportunity here. We want to become a market leader. But in the process of doing so, once we've cracked that hardware software integration, we're looking at pivoting towards a platform approach where we are bringing on other vehicles from other manufacturers and we're really able to offer a monthly plan to our subscribers or customers. And they come in, they swap out their vehicles every 2 years as their needs change. And they're really looking at using the products more so than fixing the products or owning the products. And I think that's consistent with a lot of trends we're seeing in the industry. And an interesting nugget here is that, you know, today, about 30% of our customers already finance their purchases, right? We're already rolling out services like extended warranty or premium connectivity that consumers pay for on a monthly basis. There are already a lot of signs that are telling us this monthly purchasing as opposed to a one-time capital outflow is the way to go. And we think it's got to be more of an organic evolution of our business as opposed to a revolution that sweeps the industry.
Totally. Well, I mean, I look at Unagi, right? So Unagi nowadays, it's 100% in on subscription. Have you explored the subscription question and where did you come to on that?
So we actually did a pilot on scooter subscription in Montreal last summer. And to be honest, I would love to know how Unagi is making it work because it's so freaking hard to make money in the subscription space with scooters. And we know the Unagi scooters, we've looked at them a number of times. We know what's great about them. We know what's bad about them. And unless ultimately it kind of comes down to the same denominator as shared operators, you need a vehicle that is basically a tank in order to make the numbers work. So how Unagi is able to make it work with a, you know, pretty looking scooter, sleek design, consumer friendly features, I don't know. So I'll be very curious to see if anyone can shed any light on that.
This is a really good point. I think ultimately, right. The other thing about Unagi that is interesting is that they don't have they have no IoT on the vehicle. So in the event of a loss or a theft, it becomes very expensive very quickly. So yeah, I don't know. My understanding is that they have finance providers who help them with on the other side, which helps them with being able to finance it. So they don't need to fund them on their own accord, but I don't know the details.
That's why our business model makes sense with the products that we have, is because we see every time there's a Lime or Bird fleet that launches in any city, we see a huge influx of people try it, test drive it, love it, buy their own scooter from us.
Yes.
Similar with subscription services. They ride it, they say, this is great. And we see a huge influx coming to so that. We see, even see it in our own product lineup, where someone will buy an Apollo Air. 6 months afterwards, 30 to 40% of those consumers come back and buy an Apollo City. Like, that's why the beauty of having different, like Magic was saying, having different scooters for your life stage, is because people always will evolve and always want more range or more comforts. So that's why the subscription model makes sense if you have an upscale product or a different offering for a different situation. But otherwise, I believe you would be losing quite a lot of customers after through that. But that's about it.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing as well, right, is that like your idea of a, even if you sold them scooter at, you know, I don't know, that may say the scooter price is, you know, $1,000 as a price point, and you sell it to them for $300, but then you charge them accordingly to the amount of the amount of kilometers that they do, and the thing bricks if you don't, you know, if they do it. That gets very compelling, because you really capture the value of, like, as you say, you're getting billions of kilometers. You really capture the value in those billions of kilometers, and your marginal cost for servicing those is really, really low. Actually negligible. I think that model is very compelling. Certainly very new and different. The one thing that I could see how that breaks, though, is that if people get annoyed at the idea that you'd have a scooter in your house that breaks if you don't pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, that becomes a very expensive brick, and people get annoyed about that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think we would have to take a similar approach to kind of how, you know, again, telcos do it, right? So you kind of pay for, let's say, 100 gigabytes per month, and whether you use it or you don't, you pay for it. But there is the ability to kind of scale down the plan accordingly based on your needs when you sign the contract. So we kind of see that the kind of contractual part of this model working the same way. And similarly, we could basically offer an upsell on extended warranty and take care of any servicing. So it's not that, you know, if the scooter breaks, you're kind of stuck with it for the next, you know, 18 months of your 24-month contract. You would still, of course, take care of it and make sure that you're back on the road as soon as possible. But hopefully that's when all these investments in product reliability, longevity, vertical integration with our app, proactive diagnosis, all of those things come together and actually allow us to hopefully make a scooter that does get through the 2-year period without any issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to move on to marketing and scooters. And you obviously said, you know, as you said, you started out in marketing and then that was a sort of a key differentiator for you, that you started as an e-commerce business, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what has worked and what hasn't for you in the kind of the journey of learning how to market scooters online and going direct to consumers?
Yeah, I'll start off. I think the first phase when we started was really, this was such an early product. Like, scooters, like you said, have only been in the market for 6-7 years. And the people purchasing in the start were really early adopters. They knew everything about scooters. They were super fans. They knew how to change tires. They were willing to do all of this nitty gritty. And that really differentiating point for us was the marketing availability was a huge one. Like, up to 2022, I think we were always sold out and we could never have enough stock just because nobody else was in the market. And then with 2022, we saw that huge influx. But that was it. So customer service, also the marketing side, which is really important. Phase two was really where we're going now, which is mass market. And I think a lot of consumers who see scooters are like, oh, these look really cool. And their expectation of a scooter is a bit, again, like an e-bike, or some of them, it's like a Mercedes or a BMW. They don't realize the maintenance that comes with it. And so the marketing aspect of it on our side, and even the product innovation of what we need to do, is make sure that we can advertise our product and also have the quality to make sure that you have the least amount of maintenance possible. So all our products are shifting towards that. Most of our products now have self-heating tires, so you don't have any inner tubes or flats on your scooter. They're running with a regen brake, so you don't have to change your brake pads every 2-3 months. And the marketing behind that becomes really a feature set. Today it's about, it can shift. Last year was more about have a scooter that has an IP66 rating, it goes for water, you have a good amount of range and a good amount of speed, and it's an amazing servable scooter. Today, it's shifting a little bit with the economy, and it could be like, you know, instead of spending X amount on gas and petrol, buy a scooter for X amount a month. So I think it changes a lot over the shift, but we're really just, again, focusing on those feature sets in terms of how we market the scooters.
And just to jump in, like with anything else, it sort of just comes down to having a point of difference and being able to communicate it, right? Like it's at the end of the day, it's not a new formula. I mean, it's kind of how we've tried to make it work ever since. And at the beginning, we didn't have a proprietary product. So the only thing we could compete on from a marketing point of view was that customer service experience. And now as our products are increasingly proprietary, competitive, and interesting, they sort of start to speak for themselves. And we're seeing much more success with referrals and test drives and affiliate partners and reviews. And effectively, the product starts to speak for itself. So I would say, unfortunately, there isn't, you know, a quick list of five hacks to scooter that I can share.
Yeah.
It's really just kind of doing things by the book. And like Chris mentioned, it helped that we were early. You know, there's definitely benefit, that even in terms of just building organic SEO kind of traffic and stuff like that. Coming in 4 years ago was a huge advantage.
Yeah. Yeah, completely.
And a lot of people do really need to walk the talk with their marketing. It's very easy to start. We've seen so many companies in the last 12 months start scooters and not realize the amount of servicing requirements behind it. Like, we have enormous amounts of repair centers in the US and in Canada, because that's a huge part of your customer service. And it's a long chain of everything. And if one thing collapses, the whole thing collapses. So it's easy to say, okay, like, we can repair your scooter and you have 2 years of warranty or 3 years of warranty, but you really have to back it and make sure you're committing to that and delivering. Otherwise, your brand goes away very, very quickly.
Yes. Yeah. As a kind of, so like, my understanding is, do you know what the global size of the total scooter market is on a yearly basis in terms of units?
Oh, that's really hard to say. I think that's one of the issues with the industry. It's all kind of prediction based, right?
And it's always mixed shared and owned. Yeah. Like, France, I know, sold 800,000 units last year in private ownership. In terms of the market, we can guesstimate like 5 mil, 10 mil, but it's a really big estimation.
This is so interesting. I'm amazed that you guys don't know. I mean, not because you don't know, but like, I don't know either. And I have been struggling to find that information. And we, you know, in theory,
Oliver, we bought every report.
In theory, we're the ones who build it, but we haven't got there yet, you know?
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Yeah. But it's really encouraging to see, you know, the research that McKinsey is putting out there, because it gives the whole industry a bit of confidence that actually there is a future here. And the reality is, you know, I think until we start to look at something like maybe Nielsen data for more big box kind of retailers trying to guesstimate what's being sold on Amazon, Best Buy, Costco, because honestly, those channels, at least in North America, represent the majority of the volume, then we can kind of start to build it, you know, from the ground up and get some sort of a sense of what is the total volume that's being sold on an annual basis. But otherwise, it's all speculative.
And then it's also the power of marketing behind it, right? It's like, our biggest marketing challenge is to convince people to switch away from their cars and buy an electric scooter. And 70% of people who buy our scooters are transitioning away from their cars. And then in Canada, if you look at the stats, it's like 70% of people use cars for less than 5 miles a day. So there's a very obvious use case for scooters, but you have to educate them. You have to tell them, like, lots of people who say electric scooter, they're like, oh, those are annoying, because I saw, you know, they see the rental scooters on the front page of the news and they have a negative association directly with it. And that's our part, to come in and say, hey, we actually have scooters that are very comfortable, have an amazing range, are very light and practical, and relatively quite cheap compared to e-bikes. Why don't you try and switch your car to it, right? So that market is very quickly turned to increase the size based on how you're marketing as well.
Yeah. What with the, you know, the eBays and the Best Buys going into the space, like, that is a big area that we can see that's super interesting. We're calling it the road to retail, and it's going to be part of our like conference programming going forward for the industry, is trying to get, like, how do we get Decathlon in there? How do we get, you know, how do we get Walmart? How do we get the Kmart buyers to a conference? Because we think that that's the most interest, you know, for you guys and other manufacturers who are in the space. It's like, it'll be a big mover for the industry. How do you think about it, having started as a D2C? Like, do you look at retail and go, oh yeah, we really want the Best Buy contract or the Walmart contract? Or is it like, oh no, not going to touch that with a 10-foot barge pole?
Yeah, so we're taking our time, to be honest. Like, we have great conversations with Best Buy, US, Canada, Costco. Like, they really want our scooters, which is really nice. Like, it's essentially, they've taken their business model and they're trying to adapt scooters to it. And I think the most crucial part is that, like, for example, you can return a product at any time. There's 3 months return policy. Like, you have to be really careful in terms of scooters, because there's clear, again, there's clear ways to repair it and service it. And that's why it needs to be very clear. But until the business model changes a little bit and there's like no more return, like free return policies and stuff, I think it's going to be very hard for luxury scooters to go into that model. Again, the volume is there for sure. And we see enormous amounts of all these Segways and all going into these stores. But the reality is a lot of people don't see the return rates, and we do. We have access to a lot of the stuff. And you see there's a huge amount, up to 30% return rates, and that's not part of our business model. We rather let these entry levels go into these models, these mass market models, and then come and purchase in a Prado scooter until Best Buy and these retailers sort of start adapting their model and putting return royalties and fees. And then that maybe makes sense in the future with the mass market our product.
Yeah.
Point, Oliver. I think, first of all, great idea to bring in buyers to the conferences. I think that's going to add a tremendous amount of value to the participants. I think for us, the other challenge is that as a young company, you know, one that's still in the process of becoming established, it's clear that it's very difficult to build a brand at shelf. So if you go into a Best Buy and all you see is the box, you know, you really have limited opportunity to establish what you stand for, tell your story, and bring people into the ecosystem. As opposed to when you control the entire funnel, you bring people through your ads, you know, you show them a video, you have them chat with your customer agent representatives, they get your emails, you're able to kind of really sell them on the mission more than the product. And the product just becomes a bit of an afterthought, you know? So that's really what we're focusing on today. And like Chris said, when we eventually get to a point where, you know, either we've exhausted our direct kind of funnel or we're ready for that scale, that's when we would consider.
And last small thing is, like, we'll be competing against huge public companies, have enormous amounts of capital. And I don't know if you followed, like, Amazon and Best Buy sales last year with Segway and New, for example. Both of them were competing for market share at minus 40% discounts all year long. Like, that is impossible for a private company to go in and compete.
Oh, I did not see that. That's brutal.
Yeah, and if you look at their profit reports on a quarterly basis, which are public, you see the losses they're making on a scooter market to gain that market share, which, again, at the scale we're at, we can't compete. So that's another reality as well that we have to keep in mind.
So NIU, I didn't realize NIU had gone as aggressive. I knew that they'd gone into the scooter game, and I know that they've got a couple of things. So I didn't realize that they're that aggressive in that space.
They beat Segway to most scooter sales on Prime Day last year. So, and that was their first year of operation. Wow. So they did a really good job. That's why, yeah, we were saying that the marketing and product has been good. So just, yeah.
Yeah. Gee whiz.
Yeah. Crazy world.
That is a crazy world. That's, I mean, I know that they've also had issues with customer service as well. That's been certainly one thing that's been feedback that has filtered back to me about the news. Like, great, great product, but terrible service.
Yeah. I think at that scale, you know, you kind of just treat that as a cost of doing business. You know, you simply return those and replace those. Like, it's cheaper for you to just attribute that 10% of your stock is going to be, you know, discarded or replaced than to probably invest in a real infrastructure that has servicing centers and mechanics in them and whatnot. So,
and that's why, even for our brand, like, the most important part of our brand is our customers. Like, we've always gone through the concept of 1,000 true fans, so always making sure that we have a huge group of loyal customer base that we treat well with our customer service, with our servicing infrastructure. And we generally just love the brand. And we have, again, group rides. We have a lot of swag. Like, we have all these beta program platform people. Like, it's a huge community. And I think Super 73 did a fantastic job on that. I think that's where Segway and all these big brands are going to lose on, but they can afford it. But that's always part in our DNA. It's really our customers and how we create that community behind it.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, look, this has been this has just been the most fascinating and wonderful chat. Just hats off to the both of you. I've been super impressed with everything I've seen from you and the company to date, and really looking forward to, you know, just watching you more and you grow and hopefully having you back on in a couple of years of time, and we can talk about the latest developments in the industry and what you've seen and your new incredible super lightweight carbon fiber scooters that you might end up. I want someone to build the Model 11. I want to come back to this, which is, like,
we did too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was so sad when David let me know that they weren't going to build that at the Yonagi 11. It's like the most insane scooter. It was like,
AI cameras, everything, yeah.
Carbon fiber, but cameras, ADAS, dual motor, suspension, IoT. I mean, there was a reason it was too good to be true. Yeah.
And we actually ended up in New York at one point, and we went into the store when they had a I don't know if it was a 3D printed model of the Model 11 or if it was an actual prototype, but just kind of seeing the chassis and the design, you know, it would have been an inspiration had it come to fruition. But like you said, unfortunately, it was a little too ambitious of a project, but hopefully one that they come back to at some point.
I hope so too. Brilliant. Well, hey, thank you both. And really looking forward to this, and just hats off to you for what you've built. So,
and then thank you, Oliver, for hosting this podcast and, you know, all the amazing work you guys do. Like I said, because of this massive hole in the industry, which is not really being filled by anybody, to understand what's going on across mobility, you know, it's difficult for us to operate in kind of the isolation that we experience. So you guys are kind of the only light that reaches us, and we're able to get news through. So thank you so much for all the heavy lifting that you do.
And just to add on to more, we've been listening to this podcast for like 2 years, and it's been like always an inspiration to be on it. Even the Microbiology Conference and what you guys do, it's incredible. Like, we got a chance to present the Pro there. We're presenting the Explore in September and October in San Francisco. Like, you guys are a pillar for the community, and thank you so much. It's really a huge support.
Hey, honor, pleasure. I love this work. It's so interesting. It feels like we're helping write history. So it's like most exciting thing I do in my mornings.
Amazing.
Get to get up and do this stuff. So yeah. Hey, thank you, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much, Oliver. Thank you.